Well, did you ever wonder why leaders make the decisions that they make? Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along on the Ideas Network. Our next guest is the author of a new book that takes a look at some of those decisions, 52 of them, and their historical consequences. On the phone with us today, Greg Buston. He advises leaders from around the world, actually, in a range of industries. He's written 5 leadership books, and his latest is titled How Leaders Decide, A Timeless Guide to Making Tough Choices. So we'll talk with him about some of those choices and how they can help you in making decisions in your own business life or just life in general. How do you make tough decisions? Have you learned from historical choices? You can be part of our conversation. Love to have you with us. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Greg Buston, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Larry. Appreciate the invitation.
Well, you've had a successful career. You've advised leaders or continue to advise leaders from around the world. How did you step into that role?
By accident, of course. I worked in an ad agency, and then I ran an international public relations firm. The Dallas office of that firm, started my own business, and over time, just got into the business where the things that we were working with were actually beyond the realm of communications. I mean, it really came down to making good decisions. And today, that's the business that I'm in. I run 3 peer advisory boards in Dallas. My Wisconsin connection is that my agent lives outside of Madison, and so I hope she's tuning into your show. She was very thrilled that I was invited, and in 2 weeks, I'm going to actually be on a speaking tour in UK, Ireland, Wales, England, and Scotland. So it's a fun time to be in the decision-making business.
Oh, it's got to be. Well, I really enjoyed your book, and it's designed, you can read it in short segments. Talk about the book and why you decided to do it that way.
Well, I write a blog, and what I found was that most of the responses that I got when I sent these blogs out, when I posted these blogs, I found a couple of things. I found, number one, that people were really inspired by the lessons that we can draw from history. The fact that it's a true event, and the fact that something that may have happened 100 years ago or 500 years ago is still very much relevant, was very appealing to people. And the leaders that I work with, they like this idea of sort of the snackable chapter. I mean, these are little 10-minute reads that you can ponder and think about for some time. If you want to read the larger work, I've got those noted in the bibliography. And so this is not meant to be an exhaustive examination of historical events, but it's really designed to be a little bit of an appetizer and then bring it into today's world so that people can contemplate what it means to me. And so, as I know you know from having read it, there each chapter has 3 different questions that invites people to pause and reflect and think about how those things that may have happened in the past, that did happen in the past, may resonate with them today.
Well, I found the book really fascinating, and you're right. These stories, and it's everything from Julius Caesar to
the Beatles,
Barack Obama, Marie Curie, John Adams. One of the popes, I think.
There's something in there for everyone, I think.
Charles Darwin's, I think it was pencil sketches or something.
That's correct. Yep.
So I'm trying to remember them all now. And you said, well, you can read one a week or something like that. And I found myself, I was going to read just a few, and I found myself reading through every, oh, this is interesting. That's interesting. And, you know, then I went back to the beginning of your book to kind of read what you had to say about how to read this book. And I thought, oh, you know what? These three little questions that he raises in each are really interesting in that context and how I might apply some of those.
Well, I'm glad you think so. We're actually coming out with a journal companion piece to the book in the fall, because the way it was originally conceived was you'd read the story, there would be the question, and then there would be some lines, and you could jot your thought. And we all said, hey, wait a minute, this book's getting a little too big. And also, hey, how about a companion piece? Because the people that I work with, a lot of them do like to journal, and they like to go back and read what they wrote a year or two ago and see how their thoughts then hit them today. So we're going to be coming out with a journal product, a journal companion book, where you can just actually literally, you know, write your thoughts. One of the tricky things, which I'm sure you appreciate, is the fact that I had to come up with, you know, different questions for each of the 52 events. So I couldn't just say that they all overcame adversity, or this is a matter of integrity, or, you know, whatever the case may be. So I really had to dig deep to find, you know, three different questions for each of the 52 chapters.
Well, as I looked at the different questions, I thought, well, they are relevant. Very relevant for that particular story. And to give listeners an idea, you know, I was taken by the very first chapter on the designer of the Titanic and a decision, you know, a simple decision that was made 17 months earlier or whatever resulted probably in the sinking of the Titanic.
Well, you're right. I mean, what the tricky thing about this was really not to create a book with a bunch of anniversary dates, but really to figure out, okay, at what point along the spectrum, if you will, or the decision making process, was the key decision made that then resulted in the event that we know. And so, in the case of the sinking of the Titanic, you know, some of those decisions that really contributed to the sinking were made when the ship was still on the drawing board. And one of those decisions was to lower the grand staircase and make it bigger, which had the effect of lowering the watertight compartments, which allowed water to rush in at a greater rate when the ship struck the iceberg. And so as a result, the ship, that many thought was unsinkable, of course, sank even faster because of that decision that had been made months before.
And then as you, and just to follow up, then your questions relate to that. You know, every organization, you know, has its problems, maybe not as catastrophic as the Titanic, but a lot of times those things seem insignificant at the time. Those decisions are made.
That's right. And so the question is, every organization is, I've got the book open, every organization is susceptible to catastrophe. The risks may seem unlikely or significant or insignificant. When did you last test your assumptions, and where are you vulnerable? So that's as apt today as it was 100 years ago.
Well, and then how would you I think it was something like, how would you respond to adversity was a question that you raised. And, you know, if you're in a position you don't have to be the leader of a big corporation. You can be maybe the president of your local PTA or in some nonprofit group. You're going to have to, if you're in a leader position, leadership position of any kind, you're going to have to think about these things.
Well, that's exactly right. The guest that you had on just before, Jennifer, talked about these ordinary men and women who did extraordinary things, and I think that every person is a leader in some way. I mean, you're leading yourself at a minimum, and
yep.
So how do you respond to adversity? And so, you know, a lot of these people were living ordinary lives. Some of the folks that we looked at were living ordinary lives, and they just found themselves in a position where their values were tested. And that's really one of the ways I believe that you make decisions. And we have some examples in the book of where people made some bad decisions.
Yes.
And some of those you would say, well, you know, like Watergate, it's like, hey, you know, maybe their intentions were good, but maybe their values were such that they felt like the ends justified the means.
We're going to be continuing our conversation with Greg Buston, author of How Leaders Decide, after this look at the news. So you stay with us. We'll be right back. We're talking about pivotal decisions that made history and what you can learn from them. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Our guest is Greg Buston. He advises leaders from around the world in a range of industries, and he's written 5 leadership books. His latest, How Leaders Decide, A Timeless Guide to Making Tough Choices. Well, what helps you make decisions? What have you learned from your former decisions, maybe? Give us a call with your own experiences and questions about the book at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Well, Greg, you've got 52 different stories here, and I noted the large number, that thousands of experiences that you kind of went through to come down with these 52, how did you narrow it down? You had like 10,000 different experiences or something.
Well, what I did is, I mean, you can look on the internet and type in this day in history. So, for example, on this day in history, May 30th, hundreds of years ago, Joan of Arc was burned at the stake. Well, I wasn't really interested in that. I was interested in what led up to that. And in fact, your listeners can go to my website, which is Buston.com, Bustin.com, and download for free. Right on the main page, there's a tab called The Lost Chapters, and 5 of those chapters, one of which is Joan of Arc, never made it into the book. And so that'll give your listeners an indication of what the chapters are like. Back to your question, I looked at all of these events. You should have seen my dining room table. I had little note cards spread out, and the trick. But there were a couple of tricks. One trick was to say, okay, I've got to get it down to 52. Another was that I had to find when the decision was made. So even though, you know, building the pyramids or the Great Wall of China, you know, is on every historian's top 100 list, I could not pinpoint that date. And then the other trick was to say, well, look, I'm going to organize these by month. So 5 for January, 4 for February, and so on. And so that meant I would have to make a decision, for instance, about whether the Tylenol recall, which was huge, right? 7
yeah.
deaths. It was a big thing. Do I put that in, or do I put in the Cuban Missile Crisis? And I'm like, okay, well, I think, you know, averting World War III is probably, you know, a bigger thing. And so I had to make a decision around first or biggest or only, you know, those sorts of things. So it was a little bit of a chessboard for me and a fascinating exercise.
Well, and here you are making leadership decisions.
Yeah, so my first decision was, what am I going to put in and what am I going to leave out, right?
Well, Ethan in Madison has something for us. So let's go to Ethan. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind, Ethan?
Yeah, so I'm in sales, and I think one of the biggest decisions that you have to make in sales, kind of the first epiphany that you come to, is being strategic with how you think. And so instead of running around with a chicken with your head cut off, you really need to put some forethought and time into thinking about where you want to go strategically. And what's really interesting about it, and what you don't know until you start doing sales, is that everything takes a little bit of time. So nothing's instant. Mm-hmm. You really have to recognize that, you know, when you go out there and you're trying to make a big sale or something, you really need to understand that where you put your energy and time is kind of one of the most important decisions you ever make. And to do that, you want to do the research and the homework and just be a lot more strategic about when you start a process. Because when you start getting rolling, you kind of continue to steamroll no matter what direction. But it's that moment before you start that steamrolling process of working that is so critical, I think. So that's kind of one of the things that I feel is the most important, is being strategic.
Oh, that's really interesting, Ethan. Greg, a comment.
Well, I certainly agree with that. I think one of the things that Ethan would agree with, and it's probably just ingrained in him, that even before you think strategically, I think that you've got to believe in what you're doing. And I think that you've got to believe in the product or the service that you're selling, because I think people see through that otherwise. And so I think that, you know, when you look at sales, what you realize, and I was in a form of sales as a consultant, you cannot fake what it is that you believe, because I think people will see through that. And I think more than ever, people appreciate authenticity. And then I agree with what Ethan says, that you really got to do your homework, and you've got to understand, you know, what are the facts? What are the realities? Where do we have the advantage? How do I create a relationship that's built on trust? Because I think when you're in sales, it's not something that you're doing to someone. I think that what it is you're solving a need that someone else has. And I think that's part of the strategy piece that Ethan is referring to.
Yeah. Ethan, thank you. Does that resonate with you?
That's spot on. Yep. That was great. Thanks for fleshing that out. That's
exactly right. Appreciate that very, very much. Or sell them, or give them something that they need, or something maybe that they think they need. I was thinking about who is the person now? I'm suddenly blanking. Oh, Apple.
Yep.
Talk about
Steve Jobs.
Steve Jobs, yeah. I couldn't think of his name, but
he actually quoted Henry Ford. He said, "If I gave them what they wanted, they would tell me a faster horse." Right, and so his job was to say, "I got to be a step ahead," and that's a little bit what Ethan's talking about. It's like, hey, how do you help them see a need that they may not even realize, and then have a conversation about that so that they will want it.
Let's talk about the Steve Jobs chapter, because I found that one very interesting as well.
Well, the thing about it is Apple was on the decision point was Apple was on the brink of insolvency, and Jobs had been dismissed essentially by the board, and he was brought back, and he had gone to the creators of the 1984 iconic commercial and said, okay, give me some print ads for, you know, computer magazines. And they're like, man, that's not what you need. You're going to need something bigger. And really what Chiat Day came up with was using Apple's values and using their differentiating point in the marketplace to create the think different campaign. And that campaign really turned the ship around for Apple. And so while Steve Jobs certainly deserves a ton of credit for that, it was really the ad agency that dug deep down and said, what is the essence of what we're doing here, and how do we get someone to believe in what we're doing? So more than features and benefits, they really communicated that Apple is for those who are willing to blaze new trails, because at the time IBM dominated the marketplace, and so they didn't create ads that talked about bits and bytes and prices. They created this idea that the people who used Apple products were trailblazers, and so they got permission to use the likenesses of Albert Einstein and John Lennon and folks like that, Joan Baez, to really convey this idea that these were people who literally marched to a different drummer, and as a result, the world was better off for it. And so they essentially conveyed that, or they borrowed that interest to say, this is what Apple stands for, and it really was the beginning of such a loyal following that it not only turned the company around, but it's really made it one of the most valuable companies on the planet.
And so going back to Steve Jobs, I guess the good thing he did there was actually going with what the ad agency that he selected advised.
Well, that's right. And I think that just because you're a leader, it doesn't mean that you have to call all the shots. If you're a leader, you're going to get the veto power. But I think part of the art of leadership is knowing when to trust, other people. And, on the other side of that is George Custer, who wiped out his men. All of his scouts came back and said, don't go. There are more Native Americans than we've got bullets. And Custer said, basically, I don't care. Let's go. And it was a disaster. And so I think that, part of that is understanding, sometimes you can lead from the rear. And I think that was a great case in Steve Jobs' instance, where he's like, hey, I'm paying you guys to advise me on this. And he trusted them. The thing that Jobs did for his part was to really simplify what Apple was doing, and really get rid of 80% of the extraneous products that people weren't buying and that were sapping a lot of resources, and focus on the most important products for the company. So Jobs certainly gets tons of credit for what he did. In this case, with the Think Different campaign, he had the I guess you could say the courage, if you will, to say, look, I'm going to trust somebody else with this decision.
Yeah, absolutely. In the first part of our program, and you recognized it and mentioned it, we were talking about a small group of women who were part of a resistance cell in Nazi Germany. And there's a couple of stories in your book that relate to that. You tell a story about one of Hitler's ministers, for example, who also went against Hitler. What does that story show us?
Well, the story is about Albert Speer, who was Reich Minister in Germany, and the thing that he woke up and realized one day is that he had essentially sold his soul to the devil. And the quote that I use of him, it's something along the lines of, it's a little hard to know that you sold your soul to the devil when he's patting you on the back, and that's really what Speer came to grips with, that he had really sold out, and that he was bartering his life for this opportunity to be the grand architect for Hitler, and it was really as a result of him being able to do these enormous feats, bricks without straw almost. It's like no time, no real resources, and yet he was able again and again to create these colossal designs like the Nuremberg Plaza that that we've seen in all the photos. And then he looks up and says, "My God, what have I done?" And because Hitler wanted to completely destroy Germany's infrastructure once he realized that the war was lost. And at his at the risk of his life, Speer said, I'm going to find a way to countermand those orders so that the recovery will not be as difficult as it already will be. Not to mention the fact that he saved, you know, all kinds of cultural icons and art and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, it's having the guts to step up and make those decisions. Disney is another example that we talk about. Walt Disney's brother Roy says it's not hard to make decisions when you know what your values are. you know, and it's like a lot of us know what we need to do, and I've certainly been in that situation where I know what I need to do, but it's like, man, you know, the pain of doing it is going to be maybe greater than the pain that I'm living with. And so I think a lot of times when we make decisions, we recognize that even though the decision may be painful, ultimately we know we need to go ahead and make that decision because the pain of what we're living with now is just untenable.
And Walt Disney, from that story, I mean, he hated working with bankers, but he was... But here he was in a situation with Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, if I'm remembering correctly.
That's right. That's exactly right.
He needed, he needed money to finish it.
It had just gone over budget. And finally, he's like, okay, you know, the quote from Walt is, you know, when this thing, and this is in the late 30s, and he said, you know, when the thing that was supposed to be $500,000 went to $3 million, Walt said, Roy didn't even bat an eye. He couldn't. He was paralyzed because of the cost overruns. And so Walt had to mortgage his home in order to bring, you know, one of the 100 greatest films of all time to the screen.
It just an amazing. And he brought the banker in and showed him the film, didn't he?
He did. He did. That's exactly right. And the banker said nothing. And, of course, Walt was... you know, frightened. It's like, oh my gosh, we're not going to get the money we need. And then, you know, finally the banker turns to him and says, this thing's going to make you a hat full of money.
And it did.
And it did.
And it still is. Making a Disney Corporation a hat full of money, I think. Oh man. Well, many women have and still do have to fight for equality. And Mary Edwards Walker was one of those women. Tell us about her and her leadership qualities.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up, Larry. She is the only, and I did not know about her until I got into the research. She is the only female Medal of Honor recipient out of 3,522 recipients that have been awarded the military's highest honor for bravery. And what she had to do was she was a surgeon at a time when it was not popular for females to be doctors. She volunteered for duty on the front line. She was turned down. The lesson is that she was so caring. She cared so deeply about people, so deeply about her country.
And this was the Civil War, by the way.
In the Civil War, that's correct. She was not only willing to put herself into harm's way, she would not take no for an answer. And I think it's just a great testimony to that. I've been asked. I've got a daughter. What do you think your daughter's favorite story is? I said, I don't know, you should ask her, but I do like the story of Marie Curie because her husband, Pierre, dropped his research because he recognized that Marie's research, the discovery of radium, was more important than the things that he was working on. So a lot of great women in the book as well, and all different varieties of courage and decision-making.
Yeah. And you do actually have a Wisconsin story in
there. I do. Green Bay Packers, baby. I saw that Bart Starr just passed away recently. The Lombardi story, and this is another one of these fascinating tidbits that I'm sure a fair number of people know. It was news to me. On the team before Lombardi took over, there was something like 6 future Hall of Famers and 6 or 7 perennial All Pros, and yet they had posted a 1-10-1 season. So the talent was there. They were looking for someone to bring it out of them. And I think if you're a leader, you're a coach, that's the lesson for today. And the question is, you know, who on your team could benefit from a little more focus, a little bit more of your attention to help bring out their best?
And obviously he did that very well. I think I can't remember if you had Bart Starr in that story or not.
Well, Bart was one of those Hall of Famers. I mean, absolutely. Yeah. He was on the team, and Lombardi really brought out his best.
You've worked with a lot of leaders. What are there common traits, things that they have in common that you could comment on?
Well, we've alluded to a couple of them. Believing deeply, I think, is one. I think not being afraid to confront reality. I mean, to say, look, these are the facts. The example of 3M, one of the most innovative companies on the planet, is to cultivate curiosity relentlessly. I think good leaders, as you mentioned with Steve Jobs, They rely on a team, and they engage with the team in a meaningful and collaborative way. I think other leaders, they're going to make a decision in a timely fashion. Now, timely may mean, you know, within minutes, or it may be timely given, you know, you talked about the Pope and the change that was created to move from the Julian calendar to the Gregorian calendar. Pope Gregory, it took him years to make that decision, but that decision was 1,000 years in the making. None of his predecessors had been able to do it. So when you say decide speedily, it's all relative. And I think you know, being willing to tackle change as it comes, to be on the offensive is good, and then executing dependably. So yeah, I think that there are 7 behaviors that distinguish decisive leaders. You can find that as a blog on my site as well. You don't have to buy the book. There's a ton of information on my site, including those lost chapters that I mentioned that your listeners can download for free.
Bustin.com. I tell you what, Greg, thank you so much for taking time to be with us. I really enjoyed your book, and I've got to get to your website, Bustin.com, and take a look myself. I want to read those
Very
other
good, Larry.
Chapters. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the invitation.
Greg Bustin, his book, How Leaders Decide, A Timeless Guide to Making Tough Choices. 2 great books today, and 2 wonderful authors. Thanks for listening. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston join us. Stay listening to the Ideas Network. Lots more in store.